The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
Well, jurors, Karen Reed's second trial is officially underway. The process of jury selection has begun, and the judge has been hearing all of the final issues and issuing some rulings. The last pretrial hearing was held, and a few new orders from the judge have come through. Plus, one big bombshell that literally nobody could have predicted. Now let's look at some of the highlights of what's been happening. I mentioned last week that David Yannetti has listed Brian Albert, Colin Albert, and Brian Higgins as the three third-party culprits that he plans on introducing during the trial. So here's the simplest breakdown of this. There are two types of defense that they can present about this, and they become kind of intertwined. Bowden defense focuses on the investigation, and the third-party culprit focuses more on a specific person or people who committed the crime. Now, the reason that they become so intertwined is because of how Bowden is usually laid out. So here's the deal. A Bowden defense is basically saying, look at how bad this investigation was. Anyone who would have done the investigation properly would have looked at these other people as suspects, and then the whole case could have had a very different outcome. But they didn't, so now we'll never know what evidence there is against them. Now, in this case, the investigation was obviously very problematic, so they can argue those points. For example, a dead cop was found in this guy's yard, but they didn't ask to search his house. And this ATF agent who was there had a brief romantic entanglement of sorts with the victim's girlfriend, and he was there that night. So he should have been looked at. Now, of course, we all know that defense attorneys can't just say anything they want to say, so there are standards for what's allowed in, and the standard for Bowden defense is much lower than the standard for third-party culprit defense. The third-party culprit defense attempts to establish that someone other than the defendant committed the crime. Now, the defense will present evidence that points to someone else, like plausible motives, intentions, or opportunity. Anything that shows the jury that this other person or other people could be alternate suspects, meaning that there's reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty because it could have also potentially been these other culprits. Now, the defense presented their case to the judge about why they should be able to tell the jury that each of these three people are alternate suspects, and they included their arguments supporting each. Now, Brennan says that the evidence that they presented is feeble, and he doesn't think that it should be allowed in. So let's take a look at each of the three that were named and the evidence that the defense says points to each of them, and the prosecution's response. First, Brian Albert. Why should the jury look at Brian Albert? Now, the very first thing that would normally put Brian Albert on the suspect list is the fact that John was found in his yard, right? Normally, that would make any law enforcement start to look at you. Well, except in this case. But that's the first thing. John was found in Brian's yard, and we know that Brian was home. Aside from that, Unetti says that Brian is a trained boxer, and several of his fellow officers were afraid of him. Unetti says Brian Albert does not have a good reputation among his fellow police officers, and he was known as a bully.
Brian Albert is a violent man. He was not only a boxer who punched people in the ring, he was also a violent drunk who sucker punched other police officers. Those police officers are on our witness list. He's been investigated by the Boston Police Internal Affairs for having done so. There are many police officers listening to this argument right now who are nodding their heads. We've heard from many of them.
And Unetti says that Brian was drinking heavily throughout the day and night, and he had spent that day and night with Brian Higgins. So here's why they say that the jury should be able to look at Higgins. There was a string of embarrassing and awkward texts that were read in court between Higgins and Karen Reed after she got mad at John for hanging on to the Sullivan sister in Aruba. She and John were having issues, and Karen reached out to Higgins. They flirted through text for a little less than 2 weeks, shared a kiss, and then she kind of ghosted him and was working everything out with John. So Higgins is at Waterfall when Karen and John walk in, and this is the first time that he's seen her since she ghosted him. And in she walks with John, all smiles, happy, and they were described as being lovey-dovey that night. So Higgins, who thought that he and Karen were about to start their own relationship, sees this and ends up texting Karen, saying, well? So the defense says that he's aggravated. Now, Higgins and Brian Albert had been together all day and all that evening, and they had been drinking. So the defense says that when John and Karen show up, it starts to trigger something. So the party's moving to Brian Albert's house, and Higgins sends John the text to make sure that he's coming over there. So they get to the house, and Brian's nephew, Colin, is there. The defense says that Colin and John had been in some type of feud in the weeks and months leading up to this.
He had been in a feud with John O'Keefe. He had thrown beer cans in his bushes, told him to F off. We have a good faith basis to claim that. This is the same Colin Albert who testified under oath he had never been in a fight in his life. Yet there are videos of him clearly desperate to beat up others. The same Colin Albert who had scraped up knuckles just a few weeks after John O'Keefe's death. Those knuckles looked consistent with an attack on somebody.
So the idea is that Brian Albert is a bully and aggressive when he drinks. Higgins is aggravated because Karen ghosted him, then showed up with John. And then they get to the house and Colin is there. And Colin has a feud with John. And they say that he also has evidence of violent tendencies and aggression. Now, he testified in the first trial that he had never been in a fight in his life. But there are videos of him wanting to fight someone and taunting them, and there are pictures from not too long after John's death with his knuckles all scraped up like he had been in a fight. So Colin and his uncle Brian both seem to have this fighter's reputation, and Colin has some kind of feud with John. So Unetti says that the Apple Health data and computer forensic data show that John entered the home, and then the theory is that something happened. Now, nobody really knows what happened. But they say something triggered a fight of some kind, and Brian Albert, Colin Albert, and Brian Higgins are believed by the defense to be involved somehow. Things got out of hand, and John ended up with a fracture on the back of his skull and two black eyes. He also had abrasions all along his arm that a doctor is going to tell the jury are from a large dog. Now, conveniently, Brian Albert happened to have a large dog named Chloe, who has a history of violence with dogs and humans. And Brian Albert even said that Chloe wasn't good with strangers. So Chloe sees some type of scuffle in this theory and then jumps up to defend her owner. And John holds up his arm in self-defense, which is where they think these claw and bite marks came from. So whatever happens, Colin leaves and Brian Higgins leaves. But Higgins doesn't go home. He goes to the Canton Police Department after being out all night drinking when it's snowing. Now, Higgins originally said that he went there to do some administrative work, but then the story changed to him going to move cars around for the snowstorm. Now, while he's there, he's on the phone with somebody, and by this time, it's like 1:40 a.m., so this isn't a normal time to be calling folks. Higgins goes home, but he still doesn't go to bed. He goes home, and around 2:22 a.m., he and Brian Albert exchange phone calls. First, Brian Albert calls Higgins. Then Higgins calls him back, and they talk for like 22 seconds. But the weird thing is that they both deny calling and blame it on butt dials, which is just sounds fishy. And apparently, butt dialing back and then butt answering is now a thing. I don't know. So John is found the next morning. And even though Brian Albert is a trained first responder and there's this huge police presence in his front yard, he never comes outside. And Unetti says that he ignored his duty as a first responder to help someone and instead stayed in his home to avoid anyone who may question him or his family. Now, as the investigation begins, Proctor, whose family has connections to the Albert family, tells his buddies that Brian Albert won't get any crap for this. He's a Boston cop. So the reports are written up, but there are two things that the defense points out here. One, nobody says anything about Colin Albert being at the house that night. And two, Brian Albert is the only person on the report whose first name wasn't spelled out. He's just listed as B. Albert. And the number of his home is misstated on multiple reports. It's almost like Brian and Colin are being protected or shielded during the investigation. So the defense starts developing their theory of what happened that night, and it seems like every time they make part of their theory known, something suspicious happens. For example, they begin to question the wounds on John's arm and bring it up in court, saying that they believe that John was attacked by the German Shepherd. And then suddenly, they get word that Chloe, the Albert's German Shepherd, had been part of the family for years, but she's rehomed and sent to live with someone else out of state. So it sounds suspicious, but could be a coincidence. Then the defense filed a motion to try to get the contents of Higgins' phone. So what does he do? He gets rid of it. But he doesn't just upgrade and turn it in or get a new one and throw that one in a drawer. No, he destroys his SIM card and then drives to a military base and gets rid of the phone and SIM card in a dumpster there, where there's no way for the defense to ever get a hold of it, regardless if the court order is approved or not. And he didn't back any of it up. So then the defense hears that Colin was at the house that night, despite never being included on any of the reports. So they send a letter to the prosecution while the case is pending before a grand jury, notifying them that he should be called as a witness. And only then do they finally produce information that Colin was indeed at 34 Fairview that night. So the defense says that there was a clear and conscious effort to protect Brian and Colin Albert and the behavior of both of them, as well as Higgins. And that all shows consciousness of guilt. So not only are they saying that this is the evidence that the jury should hear about the third-party culprit, but it's also showing a clear reason why investigators should have looked at those three suspects. And if they had, this case could have turned out very differently. Now, of course, the jury doesn't have to believe that this is exactly what happened. They just need to see that this is another plausible explanation for what happened based on the evidence. Because if it's reasonable that it could have happened, and those three in any combination could have been responsible for John's death, then that's reasonable doubt and a not guilty verdict, which is why the defense wants this introduced. Now, Brennan doesn't want this to come in. He says that Brian Albert is a decorated dude. He has medals from the police department, and bad character isn't enough to introduce a third-party culprit. Brennan says that Colin's knuckles were scraped up in the picture after John's death, and that doesn't indicate that he had any kind of fight with John. And he says there's no evidence of a feud between them. Now, as far as Higgins goes, Brennan says that the motive of him being scorned over this flirtatious relationship is a reach, and he thinks that this is only an attempt to take attention off of the issues and the defendant. Now, there was one moment during Brennan's argument here that was, well, it was odd. Now, we all know that Brennan is constantly bringing up interviews and things that are being said on TV and YouTube and social media. I mean, he even quoted one of the interviews that I did on my YouTube channel. But there was one thing he mentioned in this last hearing that I found kind of strange. Normally, prosecutors will quote different sources of information, but in this specific situation, Brennan quoted a radio talk show as he was talking about Colin Albert and the alleged feud between him and John.
I saw on a video that there were two radio personalities, and I have the clip, who spoke and met with Karen Reed, and during the conversations, at least they relate that there was some claims about drug issue, and according, not to the defendant, but according to the interviewers who supposedly interviewed her, they said that the story is completely false. They attribute this to Karen Reed. People are trying to make it more dramatic, like Colin would have a reason to hate John O'Keefe. That never happened, referring to some drug claim. He did not report him for anything.
Okay, so I had no idea what he was talking about. I don't get to watch as much media coverage as Brennan apparently can. But the clip was shared on social media on X by Olivia Lambeau. And here's the clip.
She was very honest with us because a big story all over the internet is that John O'Keefe was had reported Colin Albert for some drug activity before all of this happened. She said that story is completely false.
Yeah.
People are trying to make it more dramatic and make it seem like Colin Albert would have some type of, you know, reason for hating John O'Keefe. She said that never happened. There was he did not report him for anything.
So you may have heard this rumor before. Now, I didn't want to include it in this podcast because I've made a conscious effort to keep rumors out of my reporting here unless they are specifically discussed in court or court filings. There has been talk that Colin was somehow involved in selling drugs or some kind of drug activity and that John reported him, which is what led to some animosity between them. Now, I'll get to how this rumor started in a moment, but these radio hosts from the Greg Hill Show talked to Karen and asked her about this. And Karen, knowing that it was an internet rumor and it wasn't true, defended Colin and said no, it was false, that never happened, and said that John never reported him for anything. Now, there are a couple reasons why it's odd that this is being brought up by Brennan in court. One reason is that he's using this to say that there's no animosity between John and Colin, but this rumor that Karen quashed has never been a part of the defense's argument. It wasn't part of the feud that they say that they had. And the other reason is that this rumor was actually started by a social media and YouTube personality that has acted as a source of information for the prosecution. Go figure. Now, part of Brennan's argument was also the federal investigation. Here's what he said.
This was heavily considered in the federal investigation. And after that absolute thorough investigation, there were no charges. There was no evidence of third-party culprit. There were no indictments. And so, although we don't know the parameters of the federal investigation and we can only guess as to some of it, we know from what we did receive and review, it was thorough. And if there was third-party culprit evidence, we would expect that there would be a basis for it.
So the obvious issue here is that Brennan has no idea what the federal investigation consisted of. He's speculating and stating his speculations as if it's fact. And yet he points this out when he has a chance to address this afterwards.
Speaking about the federal investigation, when you were not a part of it, and talking about why a federal grand jury was convened, what they were investigating, what they found or didn't found, is complete speculation. It should not be a part of this argument. We don't know. It didn't prove anything. It's not as though they came up with a statement exonerating anyone. So that should not be considered by the court.
So both sides plead their case, and right before the beginning of jury selection, Judge Cannone made her ruling on this. She has decided that the defense can list Brian Higgins and Brian Albert as third-party culprits if they introduce the evidence properly. But she says Colin is out. Judge Cannone doesn't feel like there's evidence that Colin was at the house when John was there, and the video of him drunkenly taunting people to fight were people that weren't related to John, and there was no evidence presented to substantiate the feud between John and Colin. So, the judge rules that Colin will not be introduced by the defense as a third-party culprit. Now, the judge takes a jab at the defense's theory in her ruling, stating that their proffer to introduce Higgins and Albert is, quote-unquote, barely sufficient. And she says that the history of the first trial casts doubt on the seriousness of the claim. But she says that to protect the defendant's right to a fair trial, and since Karen has no burden to prove anything under the law, she will allow the defense to present this theory, but it can't be brought up in opening statements. We'll be right back after this. something else that was addressed during the last hearing. It was the topic of text between Karen Reed and David Yannetti. Now, I explained why Brennan wanted these in the last episode, and attorney Robert Alessi got up to argue why they shouldn't be turned over. Now, a few minutes in, the judge interrupts Alessi, and not for the same reasons that we're used to.
I now turn to the statements at issue here and their import to that analysis.
You know what, Mr. Alessi, I'm going to stop you. I understand the Commonwealth's argument regarding waiver. I understand that the request is narrowly tailored. I'm not going to need to give you this information, Mr. Brennan. I don't even think it's appropriate for my honor, so the motion is denied.
That's right. Judge Cannone interrupts and says there's no point to continue the argument. She isn't granting the motion. The prosecution will not get access to those texts. I was surprised at the ruling from the bench because that rarely happens with Judge Cannone. But I also can't help but wonder, what would have been in that data anyway? Remember, Karen's phone was seized on January 29th, and Brennan was asking for communication to David Yannetti in her phone data from January 29th and the following few days. So maybe there was nothing there anyway, but it was a big moment in court nonetheless. So let's talk about the topic that never seems to get settled, ARCA. Hank Brennan brought up ARCA again in the most recent hearing, and he's filed more motions asking for more discovery from ARCA. Now, Alessi said in the hearing, he doesn't know what Brennan thinks is out there. And in their response filed with the court, the defense has already said that most of the stuff that Brennan is asking for has already been turned over. Now, in the latest filings, Brennan has said that he can't wait until the middle of trial to get what he's wanting in order to prepare for cross-examination. So he wants Judge Cannone to have a hearing within 1 week so that he can ask the ARCA experts about their past relationship with the defense, identify any materials that they received that aren't in their report, when they received the materials, and the basis for any opinions outside of the four that were listed in the report. The defense says they already have all of that stuff. They turned everything over through discovery, and all of the opinions and basis for them are in ARCA's report, plus their voir dire and the testimony from the first trial. Brennan is also not happy because he says that 5 days before the start of trial, the defense says that they are contemplating hiring ARCA to provide some additional opinions and conduct further testing and analysis to rebut the testing and opinions that are going to be offered up by the Commonwealth's crash reconstructionists. Brennan says this can't be allowed because the deadlines for discovery, deadlines that he himself has missed, have passed. It's not surprising that the defense is wanting to do this, especially since the prosecution waited until the last minute to turn over extensive amounts of reports and discovery from their experts. It kind of left the defense no time to really prepare their defense against it. So we'll see what's allowed and what's not. But preaching about discovery violations when there's a sea of discovery violations from the Commonwealth seems a little disingenuous. Although I do understand wanting to prepare for what's coming. Now, one other thing that Brennan mentioned in his filing that he wanted to know was the source of how ARCA heard about the DNA before their testimony. It's interesting because the DNA of three individuals was found on the taillight. None of it was blood, which is what I would have expected if the taillight is really what cut John's arm, but his DNA is one of the three profiles that was found. Now, Brennan wants to know how they found this out, and a big deal was made about it in the first trial, about them not knowing this for their testing. But remember, Lally didn't turn this over until really late into this whole process, so of course they didn't have it. But they both said that it wouldn't have changed their opinion anyway. So Brennan made his long list of what he wants and says if he can't have it, then he wants ARCA excluded. The defense responded, saying that most of what he's asking for has been turned over already, or they have access to it. The few things that they're asking about that the defense can't turn over, like what was provided to ARCA, they also addressed, saying that their understanding is that, like ARCA said, they were given materials listed in their report and nothing more. Now, at the time of this recording, this one hasn't been addressed just yet. And that brings us to Dr. Welcher, who is kind of like the Commonwealth's version of ARCA. Now, in the last episode, I mentioned the fireworks that flew between Alessi and Brennan when the motions about Dr. Welcher's testimony were argued. It's my first time seeing Alessi mad like that, but I can't say I blame him. So one of the big issues here is that Dr. Welcher made a bunch of conclusions that the defense say are outside the scope of his expertise. For example, making determinations on cause of death, even though he's not a medical doctor. Another issue was Dr. Welcher saying witness testimony, or stating it as fact, when the testimony is, you know, up for debate by the defense. Now, Brennan agreed that these things are outside of what will be presented. In fact, he said that of the 140 slides in Dr. Welcher's PowerPoint, only a fraction of them are going to be used. So the argument was made that he would narrow it down. However, he didn't. So the defense filed another motion letting the court know that Brennan didn't do what he said in court that he was going to do, and now they want Dr. Welcher's testimony excluded. So Alessi points out that Brennan acknowledged the glaring problems with Dr. Welcher's proposed testimony, saying that it's not proper and that they aren't going to use those things. That's what Brennan said. He said that they would only use a fraction of it. But then, contrary to what he said in court, the presentation wasn't filtered down. And there's also the issue of addressing the methodology and how his testimony meets the standards for Daubert. Now, Judge Cannone ruled on this and said that Dr. Welcher will be allowed to testify. And if there's anything that he's testifying about that's not appropriate or outside the scope, then the defense can just object in the moment. And we have a huge bombshell that nobody could have predicted. Victoria George, a juror from Karen Reed's first trial, spoke out after one of the hearings about the injustice that she says that she has seen in this courtroom and how she, as an attorney, was disheartened by it all. Now, Ms. George was made an alternate juror at the end of the trial, right before deliberations. And now, for this trial, she has officially joined the defense team. As of last week, Ms. George, a juror in Karen's first trial, has become her attorney in this one. This case gets wilder every single day. There was another hearing last week that everybody's talking about. Now, this one was in front of Judge Sisitsky about the communications from Turtle Boy's phone that Special Prosecutor Brennan wants in order to show consciousness of guilt for Karen Reed. Now, we talked about this first hearing that they had on this in the last episode, when Karen's defense team interrupted and joined the hearing mid-argument from Brennan. But they were back in court again, and the judge was not happy. So here's the deal with this one. Brennan specifically asked for the communications between Karen and Turtle Boy. That is what he is supposed to try to use to show consciousness of guilt, because he says that he expects to see communications where Karen gave Turtle Boy information and Turtle Boy would post it. So this is kind of complicated, so I'll try to simplify it as much as possible. On March 5th, Brennan filed the motion to try to get these texts. In his affidavit to the court, he said, "It has been represented to this court by the defense counsel, Timothy Bradle, on behalf of Mr. Carney, that there is an implicit, long-term implicit mutual assistance and mutual defense agreement between counsel for Mr. Carney and counsels for this defendant." So what this means is he is saying, Brennan is saying, that there is a mutual defense agreement. And that basically means that both of the defendants, so Turtle Boy and Karen, have written and signed waivers that allow their attorneys to share privileged information. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to share anything. So Brennan files that in court documents on March 5th. And the very next day, on March 6th, defense attorney David Unetti filed an affidavit with the court specifically saying there is no agreement like this between them and never has been. On page 3 of the affidavit, Unetti says that both he and attorney Bedereau can unequivocally confirm that there has never been a joint defense privilege between Karen and Turtle Boy. That's the very next day. So fast forward 2 weeks, and Brennan is in court making his argument to Judge Sisitsky about getting these texts. This is the one that we went over last week. Judge Sisitsky read Brennan's affidavit, so he sees that Brennan is saying there's a defense agreement with Turtle Boy and Karen. And he hasn't seen Unetti's affidavit because that's not his case. He has only seen this one. So as they're going through this argument, the judge even interrupts Brennan and makes sure he clarifies that Brennan is not asking for texts between Turtle Boy and Karen's attorneys, just Turtle Boy and Karen. And Brennan says, no, he's not wanting the ones between Turtle Boy and Karen's attorneys because those are privileged.
ADA Brennan, let me stop you again. Would any of those categories include communications from Mr. Kearney with counsel for Ms. Reed?
No, I think those would be privileged.
Brennan also says that there are motions filed in Turtle Boy's case that say that there is no privileged communication in the text that he's seeking. So that's good enough for the judge. He grants this, but he was very specific in his order. Brennan can have the communication between Karen and Turtle Boy, anything that depicts evidence of witness intimidation. But Attorney Cosgrove, the prosecutor for Turtle Boy, who currently has these phone records, is the one that is going to hand it over. Brennan can't just get all of it and go shopping for whatever he wants. Simple enough, right? The judge was very clear. But there's a problem. About a week later, Turtle Boy's prosecutor, Mr. Cosgrove, tells the judge that there are communications in there between Turtle Boy and Karen's defense attorneys, and that despite what Brennan said in his affidavit and in court to the judge, those are not privileged. Because remember, the defense team said there is no mutual agreement between them. So Cosgrove wants to hand all of this over to Brennan. So now they're back in court, and Judge Sisitsky is mad. He wants to know two things. One, why Brennan said in his affidavit that there's an agreement for Turtle Boy and Karen to share everything, and why he said that those were privileged when they weren't. And he also wants to know why Cosgrove thinks that he should be handing over these communications when his order was very specific that the communications between Turtle Boy and Karen's attorneys are not included.
Attorney Brennan, you specifically stated that, quote, it's been represented to the court by defense counsel Bradle on behalf of Mr. Kearney that there's an implicit long-term mutual assistance and mutual defense agreement between counsel for Mr. Kearney and counsels for this defendant, Reed. On the basis of that sworn statement, I specifically inquired of you, Mr. Brennan, at the hearing on this matter last week, do any of the three categories of documents and data that the Commonwealth seeks by the Rule 17 motion include communications with Mr. Kearney and counsel for the defendant in this case? You replied, no, these would be privileged. So based on these representations and the court's belief that there were no privileged materials implicated by the Commonwealth's motion, I ordered that all communications between Mr. Kearney and Ms. Reed during the time frame in question with regard to these three articulated categories be produced. However, subsequently, the special prosecutor in Mr. Kearney's case, in possession of the documents in question on March 26, informed the court that, one, there are, in fact, a substantial number of communications within the documents and data requested that are indeed communications between Mr. Kearney and Ms. Reed's counsel. And moreover, the special assistant district attorney in that case took the position, contrary to the one asserted by Attorney Brennan in this case, claiming that those communications are not, in fact, privileged. So my order did not specifically exclude from production communications between Mr. Kearney and Ms. Reed's counsel because the court was told there were no such communications, and in any event, the Commonwealth acknowledged that they were privileged. So my first question is to you, Attorney Brennan. Respectfully, did I misunderstand you, or perhaps vice versa? In other words, I understood that you weren't requesting the production of any privileged communications, to wit, communications between Mr. Kearney and Ms. Reed's counsel. And as such, if that is the case, and we did understand each other, I can simply clarify my order for Special ADA Cosgrove that those claimed to be privileged communications will be excluded from the Rule 17 production, and we can move on. If that's not the case, I'd like to hear why.
Sure.
So this judge is a lot different than Judge Cannone. He doesn't let Brennan slide on this misrepresentation in open court, and he asks him to explain.
Okay, I specifically asked, does this include communications between Mr. Kearney and counsel for the defendant, Reed?
I don't doubt that you asked that. If
that is what happened, but that wasn't my answer to the question because perhaps I was focused more on Mr. Kearney.
So you confirmed today that we misunderstood each other.
Or I misunderstood. I'll take responsibility for it. But I was trying to be protective of the attorney-client privilege between Mr. Kearney and his attorneys, Mr. Bredo and Mr. Bederow.
And here's where Brennan has to finally admit in court what he did and what he has done so often. Now remember, in his affidavit to the judge, Brennan specifically said, quote, "There is an implicit, long-term implicit mutual assistance and mutual defense agreement." Okay, but here's the part that will make you lose your mind. His quote, when he quotes in this motion, he puts the quotation at the beginning of "there is an implicit, long-term implicit mutual assistance and mutual defense," end quote. And then he writes "agreement." So in his affidavit, when he's saying that, he's saying that Bredel, Turtle Boy's lawyer, said in court, and he puts quotes on it, right? He has quotation marks around this, Bredel saying that there's a long-term implicit mutual assistance and mutual defense. But then he puts the end of the quote before he writes "agreement," which it's weird to have a quotation mark in the middle of a sentence like that. But here's why. Listen to what was actually said by Bredel.
Mr. Bredel answered, "We don't have an agreement, but there's an implicit, there's been an ongoing long-term implicit mutual assistance and mutual defense that I myself have been part of for a long time and Attorney Bederow has as well."
So Bredel specifically said that there's no agreement, literally said the words, "no agreement." But Brennan left that part out, put a few words in the middle of Bredel's sentence in there to make it sound like there was. And he even added the word "agreement" at the end. That's a specific lie to the court. And on top of that, when the judge asked him about the communications with Turtle Boy and Karen's lawyers, he specifically said, "No, those are privileged," basically confirming what he wrote in his affidavit. And none of it was true. And he had to have known that because he quoted Bredel, meaning he had the transcripts. He knew exactly what was said before the part that he quoted, and he chose to leave it out, and then he chose to add the word "agreement" at the end, knowing that the part he left out was saying that there was no agreement. This is the exact kind of thing that he does consistently. But Judge Sisitsky, unlike Judge Cannone, calls him out on it. And look, I appreciate that. We need to be able to trust prosecutors, and they need to be held to a certain standard. And the bare minimum of that standard is honesty, period. So, keeping with that theme of holding prosecutors accountable, the judge then turns to Cosgrove, the prosecutor in Turtle Boy's case, and asks him to explain. Cosgrove said that the judge's order would include a lot of text between Turtle Boy and Karen's attorneys, which, remember, Brennan specifically said that he isn't seeking those because they're privileged. So the judge says, how do you think that my order would include those texts? So Cosgrove's explanation is that Karen's attorneys were acting or speaking on her behalf when they communicated with Turtle Boy. I mean, that's not really how texting works, but that's his story. So the judge makes it very clear that he said what he said, his order stands as it is, and they can't try to get around his order just to get this information to Brennan. So look, here's what this looks like from my perspective. It looks like Brennan wanted to represent that there was an agreement so that he could keep Bederow from joining the defense team for Karen Reed because of a conflict. Then, when he got that handled, he now needs the agreement to be just a misunderstanding so that he can get access to the text that he wants that would be privileged if there was an agreement in place. And Turtle Boy has publicly said that there are no communications on his phone between him and Karen Reed. He knew better than to have anything, and all of the communications that he has, he says, are in an app called Signal that makes everything encrypted so it stays private. So he says that there's nothing for Cosgrove to even give Brennan, which means no consciousness of guilt evidence that he was hoping to find. It looks like this whole situation was them trying to find a way around that. And Brennan pretended like he misunderstood the order, and Cosgrove pretended like he did too. But the judge made it clear this time, and the judge was impressive to watch in action.
We'll be right back after this.
There's another issue that is discussed at this hearing. There are three individuals who are not fans of Turtle Boy, like, at all. They can't stand him. And they make it known. Those individuals have publicly claimed to have access to confidential investigative materials. And based on the things that they've shared, it looks like someone in Norfolk County, either the DA's office or state police, are sharing private information with these people. So now there's this order for Turtle Boy's information to be turned over to the prosecution for Karen's trial, and he doesn't trust them not to leak it again. So Turtle Boy and his attorneys filed a motion to have it sealed. Now, to be clear, it's already supposed to be sealed through Judge Canoni's court, but they don't have faith in that being upheld because of what's been happening in these three individuals releasing information that isn't public. So they want Judge Sisitsky to order it to be impounded as well, so that if someone violates the order, there will be a judge who actually does something about it. And he orders it. So there are a few other updates. The buffer zone for this trial has been extended, and as a result of that, four Massachusetts residents are suing Judge Canoni, the Massachusetts State Police, the Dedham Police Department, and the trial court, arguing that their First and 14th Amendment rights are being violated. Then, two more lawsuits, one from Tom DeRozier and Michael Bryant, two journalists who say that they were barred from engaging in journalism on the public sidewalks by Massachusetts State Police, and the other from plaintiff John Delgado, who says that he was accosted by two Massachusetts State Police troopers, one of whom assaulted him and ripped off a sticker from a jacket that he was wearing that said, "Real Justice for John O'Keefe, FKR." Also, the Canton Police audit was completed, so we'll hear about the results of that in an upcoming episode. And the habeas petition that Karen filed, arguing double jeopardy, was denied. She and her attorneys have now appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, statistically, this is a long shot. The Supreme Court gets about 7,000 to 8,000 requests every year to look at cases. And of those 7,000 to 8,000, they only take on about 100 to 150. So, less than 1%. But Karen and her team filed the application and are now waiting to hear back. And finally, jury selection is moving along. At the end of the first week, after 4 days of jury selection, there have been 10 jurors that have been seated so far. Now, they're looking to get about 16, so they have 12 to deliberate, plus 4 alternates. It's moving faster than I anticipated, but the numbers are really interesting. This week, 290 potential jurors were brought in, and of those 290, 259 had already heard about this case, and 142 have already formed an opinion on it. That means that half of the jurors who were brought in have already formed an opinion on this case, and only 11% of them haven't heard of it. That's wild, right? Time is approaching, and we are getting closer and closer to opening statements in the second trial of Karen Reed for the death of John O'Keefe. Now, this one is going to be very different than the first trial, so I'll be interested to see what happens. I've partnered with Crime Junkie Podcast, and we have a brand new YouTube channel called Crime Junkie Jury, where I'll be streaming the trial every day if you want to watch it with me live. If you can't be there during the day, no worries. I'll be doing short video recaps of the highlights of each day, and of course, this podcast. These episodes will still come out each week to put everything together and try to piece together any big moments and any new information that we may get. Maybe we are finally getting one step closer to justice for Officer John O'Keefe, whatever that may look like.
My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.